It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's Black History Month, an opportunity to learn about, to celebrate the Pittsburgh region's rich African-American heritage. Samuel Black is the Director of African-American Programs at the Senator John Hines History Center. He's the immediate past president of the Association of African-American Museums. Welcome to the Confluence.
Well, thank you for having me.
This year marks 400 years since the Black arrival to North America, the first Africans arriving in Virginia by force as slaves. Last year, the African American History Commission Act was signed and created a commission to coordinate the anniversary. What do you think the importance of this commission is, or what they're trying to encourage in understanding that 400-year time period, Samuel?
Well, first, let me correct one thing. I'm one of those historians who challenged the 400 years. I'm not going to stand in its way because I know what it's about. But the first Africans who came to Virginia came as indentures.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't enslaved.
All right.
That's a misunderstanding that we have in our history. The other is that even before the English, and that's where the 400 years is primarily Anglo-Saxon recognition.
The English colonies.
Yes. The Spanish were in Florida.
Right.
And at least close to 100 years before the English began to come. So, but the 400 years is a good point to mark. But the commission, I think it's a very good idea. We've seen a number of these commissions over the past 10 or so years. Last year was the commission on Frederick Douglass's 200th birthday. There was a commission in 2007 and 2008 on the abolition, 200th anniversary of the abolition of the slave trade.
Right.
So this one, I think, is going to have a serious impact in schools and institutions across the country because it's really recognizing the arrival of people of African descent.
Right. Now, according to the website of the commission, they want to encourage civic, historic, educational, economic organizations to organize and take part in anniversary activities. Now, your exhibitions, your programs at the Hines History Center, I mean, you're already doing that. Will you add anything else, or is it just incorporating that 400th anniversary?
We're just going to incorporate it. We're not doing a special program. At this point, we don't have anything scheduled to do a special program dedicated toward the 400th anniversary. What we basically do at the History Center is we utilize the resources and the programs that we already have. So we will put an emphasis on the commission's charge within our regular programs. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, with our exhibitions that are already related to African-American history, we would just make an emphasis on the commission's charge within that exhibition.
As an historian, as an African-American man, is there pain and pride of the cultural accomplishments and contributions, but pain of those arrivals, how Africans got to this country?
It's definitely pain. A few years ago, more than a few years ago, probably over 10 years ago, I had attended a retreat in Virginia. And it was in, I think it's called Prince William County Forest, a
mm-hmm.
Big park area. And what I had learned was that that was formerly a plantation mm-hmm. and that had hundreds of enslaved people on that plantation. And it was really a somber feeling for me to know that because there's a degree of the way we look at our history and slavery as if we should dismiss it. something that happened a long time ago. But at the same time that you know that these were human beings, and human beings who many of them died, you know, without having any real salvation. And I don't want to get very, you know, religious here or anything like that, but there's a aspect of the spirit. That's what I felt when I was in Prince William Forest, was there's an aspect of the spirit of the enslaved that continues to reverberate around America. And one of the things that I do in my activities at the History Center is to always recognize that. So that not only am I teaching African-American history through our various products, but at the same time, I'm also, I think, paying homage to those who came before me. And I think that's very important. I think that most historians have that in the back of their minds.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're speaking with Samuel Black. He's the director of African-American programs at the Hines History Center. According to some government statistics I saw, Pittsburgh had the sixth largest black community in the nation in 1900, and the population grew more from the black migration from the South in the early decades of the 1900s. How did Pittsburgh benefit in terms of new residents culturally, economically?
Pittsburgh had a reputation going back to the mid-19th century as a progressive place for African Americans. It was a very militant abolitionist community. I know of, you know, formerly enslaved people who were making their way north. Many of them were going toward Pittsburgh. Some may have settled in, like, Cleveland or Detroit. But their initial place of destination was Pittsburgh, and there's a reason for that. And that reason was primarily because Pittsburgh was seen as a progressive place for African Americans. By 1900, you had roughly 39,000 black folk living in Pittsburgh area. Mm-hmm. That may not sound like a large number, but it was a significant number in terms of people finding a home, people finding an opportunity. There were hardships. There were serious hardships that existed. And but, yes, there was a steady growth over the next 50 or so years. So by 1940s, 1950s, there was over 80,000 African-Americans living in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm.
But how, so we had, that's the sheer numbers, but how did we benefit
from what the
people brought with them?
I think the city benefited a great deal. One of the things is that the way I look at the migration in my research, you had people at different statuses of life coming to Pittsburgh. You had those who were professionals. You had those who were upwardly mobile, for instance, college students. You had those who were poor, sharecroppers coming from Alabama and places like that. So you had a mixture. And at the same time, you had those who brought their culture with them. And so we know that the Southerners who came to Pittsburgh, people like Mary Lou Williams, people like Billy Strayhorn, and so forth, infused their talent and their creativity that gave Pittsburgh this great jazz legacy. And then you have others like Robert L. Vann, who becomes an attorney and the first black to graduate from the University of Pittsburgh School of Law in 1909, who later leads this newspaper, the Pittsburgh Courier, to become the most significant African-American newspaper of the 20th century. So there's great contributions that African-American migrants have made to the growth and prosperity of Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple of minutes left. Today's President's Day, now popularly seen as a day to recognize the lives and achievements of all of America's chief executives. Just a bit over 10 years ago, Barack Obama made history when he became the first African-American to become president. How is that added to Black History Month celebrations?
I think that a number of people are recognizing that as a part of the contemporary story in Black history. In a talk I had given recently, I talked about the 2010 census, and this was outlined in a book by a late historian, Ira Berlin, that in the 2010 U.S. census, 25% of the people who identified themselves as African American were either born in Africa or their parents were born in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very shocking statistic. Barack Obama, as president at that time, was the greatest example because his father was born in Africa. So you're beginning to see this demographic shift and a new wave of immigration and migration amongst people of African descent in America. But Obama's role as president was monumental historically.
Just a couple of sentences. Who were you excited to celebrate this year? Pittsburghers who deserve more attention than maybe they received in prior years?
Well, you don't ask any easy questions. probably Daisy Lampkin.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Briefly, tell us about Daisy.
Daisy Lampkin was a suffragist, head of the Lucy Stone League for a number of years, and was the field secretary for the NAACP from the mid-1940s to the early 1960s. It was during her term as field secretary. The field secretary is basically responsible for growing the membership and the impact of the organization. So during her term in that office, we saw the Brown v. Board decision and the height of the civil rights movement.
Right. Samuel Black is the director of African American programs at the Hines History Center. Samuel, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin, and you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris, still ahead on The Confluence. It started with a food truck, now a full-blown diner. One local restaurateur is giving former inmates a second chance and including other types of disadvantaged job seekers. And Pittsburgh native and veteran astronaut Mike Fink has spent more than a year in space, and this summer, he's going up again. Hear why he was surprised to get this latest assignment. Hear conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Edgeworth native composer Ethelbert Nevin dies in 1901. The pianist was the son of a musician and a newspaper editor. In fact, the first grand piano ever taken across the Allegheny Mountains was for his mother. Young Ethelbert studied in Germany, Boston, and he taught in Paris. He wrote primarily for piano, with his best remembered pieces being Narcissus from the Water Scenes, The Rosary, and Mighty Like a Rose. His face was featured on a postage stamp in a 1940 Famous American series. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Hillsides and vacant lots are magnets for illegal dumping. Today, a profile of a local nonprofit that removes debris throughout the county. 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook reports Allegheny Cleanways works with residents to clean up illegal dump sites.
Even on a wet February day, the gray skies and constant rain does not stop Allegheny Cleanways from doing what it does best. On this day, volunteers are removing piles of trash from empty lots, alleyways, and residences in Homewood. Since its founding in 2000, the group's focus has been on cleaning up illegal dump sites all over Allegheny County.
We have two programs. We have our land-based cleanup program, Dump Busters, and that's crews of people going out, cleaning up dump sites in different communities. And we have Riverfront Cleanup, which is our tireless project, and that is going out on the river on a boat and cleaning up our riverbanks.
Volunteer and outreach coordinator Hannah Samuels also says there is a psychological element to their work.
One of the main reasons why cleaning up these neighborhoods is so important is green spaces are better for mental health for those communities.
Over the past 18 years, more than 13,000 Allegheny Cleanways volunteers have helped clean up more than 5 million pounds of garbage. The group learns of problem areas through tips received by phone or email from community members. In 2018, they conducted a
comprehensive dump site survey of the entire county. So we have a map that goes through every dump site in the county. So we have a very big take on all of the different neighborhoods and problem areas.
We would basically drive down the street, we see a dump site, stop, take pictures of it, record it.
As for funding, Allegheny Cleanways receives grants from foundations and individual contributors. The truck they use was donated by the EQT Corporation. Crew leader Al Chernoff says the city of Pittsburgh also helps keep costs low.
We have an agreement with the city that we're allowed to take the garbage to their public works facility. It's a transfer station, as opposed to taking it to a commercial dump site, which would cost us money.
Homewood is one of the primary focus neighborhoods.
Allegheny Cleanways and the work that they have done in Homewood has been tremendous.
That's Operation Better Block Executive Director Jerome Jackson. And he says the trash, often found in abundance in Homewood, is dumped by people who don't even live in the neighborhood.
I will say that contractors use Homewood as a dumping ground. Whether it is they are fixing up somebody's house in Homewood and they don't want to take it to the dump and pay that extra fee to dump, we find people throwing tires and everything.
Hannah Samuels says the reception from local residents has been positive.
Everybody has been extremely kind and receptive. We'll be cleaning up and someone wanders down the alleyway and they start picking up litter.
She shares a voicemail left by a woman who called into the tip line.
Someone dumped who knows what in that lot. And if you could check the whole alley, I would appreciate it. I appreciate your company, that you are a blessing sent from heaven. Have a blessed day and a blessed weekend. My telephone number is 412.
We always call that positive community engagement. Every interaction, we're always looking for something good.
I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC.
Still to come, a conversation with Pittsburgh native and veteran astronaut Mike Fink, who's returning to space this summer. But first, Jordan Robars started the Revival Chili food truck 2 years ago with the intent of providing an opportunity to former inmates. In January, he bought Nancy's Diner in Wilkinsburg, expanding his mission to include all types of disadvantaged people. 90.5 WESA's Mick Stinnelli sat down with Robars to talk about the experiences that inspired him to serve up second chances.
I was actually arrested when I was in college during my first year for underage drinking, as well as a few other charges that happened. And I didn't think anything of it at the time. However, when I was graduating from college, I was denied from pretty much every single job that I applied to. So sometimes they would say to me, this is why you're not getting the job. And other times they would just, I would just not get the offer. But a lot of times I would get to a final round and then receive a call a few days later saying like, yep, sorry.
So how many employees do you have working at Revival Chili?
So for the food truck, it's actually just one full-time, hoping to get into two full-time for this year. However, that was kind of the reason that I started immediately looking into brick and mortars within 3 months of launching the food truck. Because I quickly realized, I mean, before I started the food truck, I was like, all right, we're going to go 7 days a week, lunch and dinner. I'm going to be able to employ 5 to 7 people full time, and very, very quickly realized that Pittsburgh is not the correct industry for that at this time for food trucks. And so then I realized I could not reach the full potential of the amount of people that we could impact with just the food truck.
And what does that lead you to recently with Nancy's Diner?
Yeah.
So how does that happen? Why Nancy's? And then how does that play into the mission that you started with Revival Chili?
When I started looking at the brick and mortars, we were looking at lower income communities in general, which is where we wanted to be able to start, because the brick and mortar to me kind of signified, okay, this is where we are really going to get our foothold in and we can have a large impact on the community. So that's why when I was lucky enough to find Nancy's and I kind of saw it as more or less a perfect opportunity to take something that has a stronghold within the community. It's been around for 44 years and it's a community staple. So with the food truck, we had a big focus on specifically re-entering citizens, people that have spent time in jail. And with the diner, we expanded that to be all people with barriers to employment. So therefore still a focus on people that have spent time in jail, but that also allows us to, you know, capture veterans, homeless, people with large skill gaps or gaps in their employment history that might be overlooked by other employers.
Entrepreneurship often focuses on individual self-made idea, but you've taken a sort of spin on it and turned it into a community service, which a lot of people would say is an outward action. How do you blend those two?
The goal of this is not just for my personal benefit. I mean, I'm excited about it. And of course, if we make some money, that's a lot of fun. But we want to be able to spread the wealth and say we are all bringing each other up together. And so leveraging each person's skill set. For example, there's a guy in the restaurant who was there when we took it over. And he has 15 plus years of house remodeling and painting experience. I'm like, that is an extremely valuable skill set, right? And now you're just a line cook at a diner. Like, what's going on there? So trying to dig in deeper into, okay, how can we leverage what he's doing for the betterment of our entire Revival community?
Jordan Robarge is the founder of Revival Chili Food Truck and the new owner of Nancy's Diner in Wilkinsburg. Jordan, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Mick Stanelli, and you're listening to The Confluence.
WYEP celebrates Black History Month with a musical reflection, Strange Fruit. The lights in the Cafe Society, an integrated nightclub in Greenwich Village, dim, and the house band begins to play a mournful melody. 23-year-old Billie Holiday steps into the lone spotlight. Only her face is illuminated. She begins to sing.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
This is how Strange Fruit was first presented to unsuspecting audiences in 1939. It was Holiday's closing number, and there was no encore. Service at the club was stopped before the song began. Audience response was hushed as the graphic details of the song penetrated.
Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rise.
Fearing retribution from retailers and radio affiliates, Columbia Records provided Holiday a one-session release from her contract in order for her to record Strange Fruit for the Commodore label. Over time, this ballad about the lynching of Black Americans became Billie Holiday's biggest selling record and was an integral part of her live repertoire. For more audio celebrating Black History Month, listen to WYEP throughout February or go to WYEP.org/Black History Month.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When the first crewed test flight of the Boeing Starliner launches later this year, 22-year veteran astronaut Mike Fink will be on board. He's a Pittsburgh native, more specifically Emsworth, and he's on the line from the Johnson Space Center in Houston. Mike, welcome to The Confluence. Pleasure to talk with you.
Kevin, it's great to be here, and greetings and hello to all of the greater Pittsburgh community. It's good to be back home, even if it's just virtual.
Mike, you have flown other missions, I believe two separate expeditions to the International Space Station, plus the last mission of the Shuttle Endeavour. Give us a sense, if you would, of how this one that's going to be taking place later this year will be different.
Well, Kevin, a great question. So my first two flights, who would have ever guessed that a kid from Pittsburgh, you know, Emsworth, would be launching off of Yuri Gagarin's launch pad. But the spaceship itself was the Soyuz, and it's a fantastic spaceship, but it was made in the 1960s in Soviet Union. We've upgraded it since then. It's a great spaceship, but it's 1960s and 70s technology. The next flight was on the space shuttle, which was great, you know, 1970s and 1980s technology.
And
now I get to go on a test flight on a Boeing spacecraft called the CST-100 Starliner, and yeah, we're using modern technology to go to the International Space Station.
Must be exciting, a new ship for you.
Oh yes, well, and that's my what I had my training in the Air Force as a flight test engineer, testing new aerospace vehicles, and this is definitely going to be a flight test. In fact, the name of our mission is called CFT, or Crew Flight Test.
And so what is the purpose of this crew flight test?
Well, we're going to be the first people to check out the spacecraft to make sure it's good, run it through all of its paces, even to the edge of the envelope on a few things. And then we'll once we get to the space station and bring it back home safely, then NASA's going to say, hey, this is a certified way to get up and down to space. And we'll be able to fly our astronauts on a regular basis like we do with the Soyuz. We'll also be able to launch from Florida on the Boeing Starliner CST-100.
You were not originally scheduled to fly this mission. Does that add maybe extra excitement?
Well, yes. Life is always exciting. I've been working with the program, and I was kind of the, I guess, local supervisor or the leader for all the astronauts who were going to be flying. And so I've been with the program and understanding, you know, how CST-100 was developing along with the SpaceX Dragon. And my friend Eric Bo, he got, you know, named to the flight. I was very happy for him. And then, you know, he has a small medical thing, and the doctors and here working it out. But and so hopefully Eric gets to fly again. But they needed me to step in, so I bring my experience and familiarity with it. But you know, this isn't the way to. We always want to get a, you know, always want to have a space flight. This isn't the way we want it to happen. But we got to keep the mission going so that we can send more and more astronauts to the space station.
So that Eric has another chance, right?
We are very hopeful for that, and we're still good friends, even though I took his spot.
Okay. You know, several astronauts have gone into space in their 50s. I believe you're 51. Did you expect, however, another opportunity?
I did not expect an opportunity, but since we landed on Space Shuttle Endeavour 8 years ago, I wanted to go fly again. It's my calling. It's what I wanted to do since I was a kid. So this may be my last flight. If I have to wait 8 years between every flight, and if I fly when I'm 52, then it's just going to be harder to pass the medical exams when I'm older. But I really enjoy being in space. I love our International Space Station, and it's just a thing I think I was meant to do.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is veteran astronaut, Pittsburgh native Mike Fink, who will be on board the test flight of the Boeing Starliner later this year. Mike, little kids, maybe first graders, they're often asked by their teachers, their parents, what do you want to do when you grow up? A common response used to be an astronaut. So I have to ask you, was that your reply? Did you always want to do this?
Kevin, since I watched people walk on the moon in the late 1960s, I watched the very first moon landing and all the other ones to 1972. That's exactly what I wanted to do. I learned how to read so I could read more about space. And you know what? You still ask those first graders and kindergartners and second graders what they want to be when they grow up, and not just boys, but girls too, they'll still say astronaut.
So you think there's the same level of enthusiasm? Because I think different stages of space discovery, space flight, sort of get a surge of interest, whether it was the Apollo 11 landing or future landings, and then, of course, the whole history of the shuttle missions and so on. Do you still sense that same level of interest?
Absolutely. It's you're absolutely right, though. It you know, there's been a slight change in how it's perceived. In the 60s and 70s, astronauts, they were very rare, and it was, you know, you were kind of the top of the pyramid, so you were special. I'm using air quotes. Now we've been flying in space on a regular basis. We have the International Space Station. It's part of our culture, part of our expectation that we have people that fly in space. So yeah, sure, astronauts are still special. It's a hard job to get into, but people expect that to be one of their options. And just like being a fireman or a doctor or an astronaut. And so the kids in Pittsburgh, you know, if any of them are listening or parents, hey, stick with it. If I can become an astronaut, then I see lots of future Pittsburghers becoming astronauts too.
The craft you'll be using, you'll be aboard, is the Boeing Starliner. What are your thoughts in general about the private sector getting more and more involved in space flight? I know they've been involved really since the beginning, but a greater involvement.
Well, you're right, Kevin. This is a different way of doing things than we have in the past. In the past, NASA would work on the contractor with a design. We'd pay big money to get it built, and then NASA owned the spaceship or the rocket. Now we're doing it a little bit different. We're working with both the Boeing company and SpaceX, Elon Musk's company in California, and we're helping develop and doing a little bit of the design, but mainly it's coming from the companies themselves. Mm-hmm. NASA engineers we're focused on building a third spaceship that's going to go to the moon and beyond called Orion. But the commercialization of low Earth orbit is one of our national goals and objectives, and it's going to help make industry in space, more people get a chance to go fly in space, bring down the cost of launching into space to make it lower, make life better on planet Earth, and increase our country's economic capacity to be a high-tech company. And those are the trends we're seeing in the industry right now, not just aerospace industry, but in general. You know, we're less of a manufacturing country as we are a high-tech country, and that's the engine of our economy. And so this is a natural way for us to progress, like we did with airplanes 100 years ago. Very few people got to fly on them. They were a little less safe, and now, you know, just about everybody gets a chance to fly on an airliner. It's a super safe way to fly or to travel, and we're trying to do the same thing with the space business.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the benefits of the private sector getting more heavily invested, involved. Are there any concerns, you know, sort of no more science for science sake, no more space exploration for its own sake?
No, of course, we should always watch out for that. But we at NASA, because we know that we can trust Boeing and SpaceX to take us to the International Space Station safely, then we can focus on that exploration for exploration's sake, and that we can send people back to the moon on our new Orion spacecraft and our new SLS rocket. And those that spacecraft and that rocket, they're just a year or two behind us right now with the commercial crew program with the Starliner and the SpaceX's Dragon. So we're getting into a very interesting operational time to go send more people to space and beyond low Earth orbit. The last time we had anybody beyond low Earth orbit, any human being, any American, was in 1972. And we're getting ready here at NASA to do it again.
Mm-hmm. February 12th, NASA gave up trying to revive the Opportunity rover on Mars after 15 years of service. Opportunity had been silent since June. Still another rover on the other side of Mars. Two more, I believe, are due to arrive in 2021. Are we, in your thought process, any closer to putting people on Mars than we were maybe 5-10 years ago? Why or why not?
Yeah, Kevin, fantastic. I was aboard the International Space Station on my first mission in 2004 when the Spirit and Opportunity landed on Mars. And I remember that day, and I even made a call down to congratulate the folks at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory who planned and executed that mission. And I'm super proud of them. They were only supposed to last 90 days, 15 years, right? Mm-hmm. And we are exploring Mars. We're getting to know more about it and picking out great places for humans to go explore when it's the humans' turn after the robots. And yeah, in the past 5 or 10 years, we've had a sea change in how we have rockets that go to space. We now it's the cost of sending things to space is lower. We have new companies out there like Elon Musk, SpaceX. We have Northrop Grumman that has a new rocket too, as well as the United Launch Alliance working, you know, that currently makes Atlases that we're going to fly on, and Deltas. They're working on new rockets also. And so we are actually a lot closer. We have better launch capability. And then, of course, NASA's Space Launch System, the SLS, is a super big rocket. So we're going to be able to send a lot more things into space, including humans. So I think we are closer to Mars. Now, how soon will we get there? Elon Musk in California thinks we'll be there in a year or two. It's going to take us a little bit longer, in my own opinion. But we're definitely headed in the right direction. I wish I were a little bit younger so I could go.
Well, let me follow up on that, because with something like Mars, how does it feel knowing your work is getting us closer to that next great leap in exploration, but you might likely not be able to take part in that big trip?
Well, that's part about being on a team, right? We all do what we can to help the goal. I mean, that's what it probably feels like to sit on the bench as a Steeler, right? Not everybody gets to make every play. And yet you know that you're doing a good job in helping the rest of the team move forward and into the playoffs and Super Bowl. And that's what I look at it. It's like, you know, I've had a great opportunity. I've been an astronaut for 20-something years, and I'm going to be cheering my friends along the way. And when I'm not flying, I'll be helping others to fly. And it's fun.
Final question. Many people might know that you were in, I believe it was the final episode of Star Trek Enterprise, better known as Just Enterprise, which was set in the 22nd century, 100 years before the original series Star Trek. So what do you think? I don't know if you have a crystal ball. Where are we going to be in terms of space exploration in the 22nd century?
Oh, boy, I would love to have a crystal ball. But one of the reasons why I enjoy Star Trek in general, as well as Star Wars. But on the Star Trek universe, Enterprise was in its first or second season when I first watched it. I even watched it, episodes from space, and that's where I was thinking, where would we be in the 22nd century? And Enterprise painted a really good crystal ball. I'm looking forward to humans learning to work together and not fight each other on this planet. I'm looking forward to humans having an industry and living and working on the moon in a colony on Mars. And that way, all of our eggs aren't in one basket. I look forward to human beings using our ingenuity to help each other and to make life better for everyone, as well as move a lot of things off of planet Earth so that we can have the garden planet in its pristine condition and move all the heavy, any dirty industries we have into space where it doesn't affect the ecosystem. We have such a beautiful future in front of us, and we know this in Pittsburgh, right? We had a city that would, by most accounts, was dirty in the 1940s. We've cleaned up. We learned how to work together in Pittsburgh. We're a great family in the city, and that same feeling that we had in the TV series Enterprise, but that's a feeling that I think we should take forward as human beings, and that's the optimistic future that I hope we have. And I hope you and I are around 100 years from now and see how good that crystal ball came true.
Mike Fink is a 22-year veteran astronaut. He's a Pittsburgh native, and he will be on board when the first crewed test flight of the Boeing Starliner launches later this year. Mike, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Kevin, great to be here and great to be with you. Hope we can do it again.
Good luck to you. And finally today, Pennsylvania's new mandatory threat reporting system for all schools, K-12, drew nearly 5,000 tips in its first month. The reports to the Safe to Say Something program come into the Attorney General's office through the phone, email, and via an app. According to the Attorney General's office, those tips have included suicide threats and situations where students may have hurt others without intervention. Other common subjects of calls include harassment, bullying, and mental health issues. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Meg Fair and Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.